I know there's always that bit of intake of breath when you look at the cost for what it costs to be away for a weekend. That's true, and particularly if you've got a family. But you know, it's so hard to quantify, isn't it? What happens when every 2 years there's one opportunity when we can have extended time together? There's something very different about coming in like this on a Sunday morning for a couple of hours and going away again, or just being with each other for a whole weekend. And it changes relationships. And I think it gives space to develop some of those spiritual connections and to be led through a series of teaching together. And, you know, again, I just want to reiterate that please just see if you can possibly free that up in your diary to be there. And if there's a financial issue, then please do talk to the treasurer for the weekend over there. Stand up. There we go. Yee. And or Chris, and because we would love to help you to get there. But it, you know, it's just this, you know, sometimes we hear about blessings, and sometimes we're actually present to be part of that blessing, aren't we? And I would just hate the good folk here who hear about lovely things going on and you've missed it. And so please, just, you know, get yourself there if you possibly can. I know there's some reasons why people can't get to these things. That's absolutely true. And there's some people who these things don't work. And I know all those things. So I'm not accusing anybody. But for the run-the-mill of each of us, if we can be there, it would just be so special to be together. How many places have we got left? How many places left? There's not a sharp cut-off, so we can carry on growing. So there's no pressure, but it probably be easiest if you get safe sooner rather than later, because that just helps, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay. Right. Let me give myself some room. So they're the commercials. Right. Thanks, Dave, for leading this morning. And that song that we came into the message with just really fits so beautifully, isn't it? That we talk about the stars, because we're with on the shepherds today, and the light of the world is an interesting link there, isn't there? But also the series on nativity scene, that it's, this was something seen. This is about witnessing the events. And that song just talked about God shining on us, and he shines onto us with his revelations. I've got here a rather special file, and these are my father's memoirs from the war, which he wrote up. Some of you knew my father. I think you met my father here, didn't you? Some of you years ago, and so there he is getting his gong from Montgomery, and here's his account of going in on D-Day, and it goes on like this. And it's a fantastic thing having memoirs, isn't it? There are also some of those little things which become. You think, well, I wish I could ask Dad, because there's stuff in here that I didn't know about. And so he gives this account of an action that was particularly heavy, and where he was quite exposed up in a frontline position with a group of infantry people, and he got there as close support with artillery, and it was a very dangerous situation. And then the situation moves on, and it becomes safe, and he gets withdrawn, and he comes down from there, and he arrives back at the location for his troop, and James Henderson, that's the guy over the battery, agreed with me with the comment, "I expected to see a very haggard Smith. Whatever my appearance was, I felt haggard, though he invited me to share the cottage with the other officers. I declined, wanting to be on my own. So I dug my own trench and spent a few days as a recluse." You know, you think, you just want to ask your father, don't you? What was that about? What did that feel like? And I won't be able to ask that. You know, and a bit further on in here, there's this really frustrating bit. "Climbing back into the Jeep was like returning to reality. For a short time, we had been in an oasis. Now we were to go back to the desert, but hopefully we'd be the better able to survive. As in recent approach to Somerville, verse 4, and I'm
it goes off the end of the page and it's not there. And I'll never know what bit of scripture has spoken. And I can't say, Dad, what was that? Because he's not hearing longer. And there's also lots of bits in here where when we were, Mary and I were reading it, I had to interpret things to Marion, because I grew up in that world and I heard a lot of the letters for different things and I know what they mean. Marion doesn't. And the longer we get from the event, the harder, the more people have to look back into their history and say, what does that mean to understand this text? And I just found that was a really interesting kind of insight for me into the whole business of looking at Scripture, because we have these eyewitness accounts. This is a nativity scene. These are things which are seen. And in fact, you know, although in this day and age, a lot of people will put Mark's gospel as the first gospel written, the ancient tradition of the church is very much that Matthew's is the first gospel. Let me read what Eusebius, writing in 260 AD, or between 260 and 340 AD, wrote. Matthew had first preached to Hebrews, so he's preaching to Jews. And when he was on the point of going to others, so Matthew's been preaching to his own people, the Hebrews, the Jews, and now he feels it's time to move on because he's got the commission to move on. And when he was on the point of going to others, he transmitted in writing in his native tongue. So he wrote it down according to tradition in Hebrew. The gospel according to himself, and thus supplied by writing the lack of his own presence to those from whom he was sent. So I have in writing what I can't have with my father's presence. I can't talk to him, but he's given me this in writing. And Matthew's saying is, I'm giving you in writing what you can't have because I'm moving on. I'm the witness. And I just want to say to Matthew, where did you get the story of the Magi from? You know, you did you talk to Mary? Because he would have met Mary. She was there with the disciples quite often. Mary, the mother of Jesus. Was it Mary told you? He would have known James, the brother of Jesus. Was it James who told you? How do you hear it? Give us a bit more detail. Wouldn't you want to do that? And then there's context, but we're going to read the story. But so the way this sermon's going to work out this morning is I'm going to paint a bit of the background, and then we're going to read the scripture, and then we're going to talk about some of the things I think God's saying to us in it. And I just think I want to pick up really from where John was last week, talking about these events in history. And we can spiritualize them and we can say these are picture language or whatever. But last week was about the conception of Jesus. God entered this world and created something unique and new. And it was a point in history that he did something. And here again today we have this point in history. So we're going to be looking at, first of all, Herod. Then we're going to look at the Magi. Then we're going to be thinking about what the star is. So who is Herod, first of all? Who is Herod? Well, it's Herod the Great. And he reigned for just a little bit over 30 years. And he was he was definitely a remarkable man. He's called great because he single-handedly really created a dynasty from more or less nothing. His father kind of set the ball rolling, but really Herod managed to step up from being an appointed nobleman to being the king of the Jews. Actually, in fact, he was declared king of the Jews. Herod was by the Roman Senate. He did a lot of building. So, you know, you've seen pictures of the model of Herod's temple. Herod's temple, the second temple, which he renewed. You've seen pictures of the Wailing Wall. That's part of his building. You've heard of Masada. That's one of the several forts he built. You may have heard of Philippi. There's Philippi on the coast, not far from it's north on the northwest coast of Israel. Anyway, that region. But is it Philippi? There's lots of Philippi's anyway. But this one there, and there he developed. Or he was able to find new techniques for building concrete underwater so he could make this fantastic structure. And there's lots and lots of physical
remains of Herod around. And so he created a dynasty. He did a lot of buildings which still remain. He managed to survive for 30 years. But he was also a troubled, vulnerable, paranoid, and probably depressed man. Ethnically, he was an outsider. His father was, well, his he was as well, I suppose. His family line was Idumean. Now, the Idumeans, which, as they were called at that time, are actually the old Edomites. And you know there was often quite a bit of tension between Israel and Edom. Edom's just the south of the nation of Palestine. And he, ethnically Edomites. About a century before, the king of Israel had gone into that territory and said, either I'm going to expel you, or you've got to convert to Judaism. So a lot of them converted to Judaism, including his own family. So there was always a suspicion that he was just Jewish. He'd been raised Jewish, but just because they had to. And his lifestyle did show he wasn't exactly a man of faith. He lived in brutal times. You know, when you actually look at the catalogue of people he engaged with, or his family engaged with, it's amazing. His father had personal dealings with Pompey the Great and Julius Caesar. So Pompey the Great appointed him. Now, Pompey the Great and Julius Caesar, these guys fought together in various wars, but then later on, it was Julius Caesar who invaded the Roman Empire, and Pompey was killed. So dangerous times. And then Julius Caesar gets himself stuck in Alexandria, so Herod's father has to go and rescue him from there. So that's how the family get very well connected with the Roman people, because actually his father rescues Julius Caesar. But Julius Caesar himself is then murdered, isn't he? As we know famously from Shakespeare's plays, he gets murdered himself. He's assassinated. So that's two assassinations of people they've dealt with personally. And the two people two of the group who go after the assassins are Mark Antony and Octavian. So they're fighting on the same side. And Octavian actually is the guy who elevates Herod to positions of power in the first instance. But later on, Mark Antony marries Cleopatra, Antony and Cleopatra, and Octavian decides this isn't on, and so he goes and he fights with Mark Antony and Cleopatra, and actually Antony and Cleopatra end up committing suicide. You know, I mean, if you've got paranoid tendencies and you're looking around at the leaders around you, we think we've got trouble in our political world here. I mean, all these guys who've been allies, then killing each other or causing each other to commit suicide or having each other bumped off or whatever. His own father was assassinated. So this guy has reason to be nervous about power. And but his desire for power was actually probably the biggest problem he had. So at one point he goes off to Rome to ask for his job as governor of Judah back, and they announce him or proclaim him king of the Jews. The only problem is there's somebody already in the land who is trying to be king of the Jews. So Herod comes back to Palestine and thinks, how do I, as an outsider, get myself a bit of favor with the Jewish people? I'll marry the granddaughter of the last Hasmonean king. The Hasmoneans were a dynasty which was liked in Israel. I'll marry the granddaughter, Mariam. So he marries a granddaughter. Only problem is he already has a wife and a son, so he banishes them. So he just banishes a wife and a son so he can actually have some favor with the people there. He then thinks, well, I'll appoint her brother as high priest, which again will curry more favor with the people. The trouble is it's a bit too much favor because actually the brother is more liked than Herod himself. So he gets jealous. So at a party at Herod's palace, this brother-in-law of his wife is found dead in one of his pools. You know, it's never been proved, but she certainly believed he had bumped him off. And their marriage became very cold. And then he actually bumps off another of her brothers, because he is definitely plotting against him. And then later on, he actually bumps her off. And this is the woman he actually
apparently really loves. And then later in life, he bumps off his two sons by that woman because he thinks they're plotting against him. And he bumps off an uncle. And then later on again, he bumps off the son who he banished in the first place from his first wife. So you're talking about a man who has actually bumped off one wife and one son. Banished one wife and one son, who's killed a wife, two brother-in-laws, an uncle, three sons, and many others. He was a bit paranoid. Could this man kill the between 7 or 20 little boys below the age of 2 in Bethlehem? Pretty easy. And people have said, well, it's not in the historical record. Well, actually, there's a handful of little boys in a little village wouldn't get a mention, would they, in history? So it would be unlikely to. It's not that surprising. Okay, that's Herod. Into his capital city, with this man, with this paranoia, who's been declared king of the Jews by the Romans, ride some happy magi. And they says, where is he who's born king of the Jews? It's funny, nobody looks very happy around here. I tell you, I reckon they probably realized pretty early on that they were on a loser, because, you know, when you ride in and actually the palace knows nothing about a successor, in that kind of world, you're probably thinking, maybe we should have done this a little bit more subtly. But anyway, they've ridden into this place and said, where's the king of the Jews? So who are the magi? Well, magi, the term magi had become the common term for magician by the time of Christ and in late antiquity. So the word magician comes from the word magi. It's magic. Particularly experts in astronomy and astrology, that kind of area. Alchemy, you know, fiddling with substances and other forms of esoteric knowledge, including some of the things we associate with sorcery and magic. So actually, the same word in the New Testament is used for Simon the Sorcerer. Do you remember Simon the Sorcerer who wanted to buy the power that the disciples had? He's called Simon the Sorcerer, Sorcerer, Magi, same word. Then there's this character, Bar-Jesus, who was on the island of Cyprus when Paul was doing his mission. And this guy was the assistant to the governor on the island of Cyprus. And he didn't like what Paul was doing. And he is called a sorcerer. Same word, magi. So that's what magi means. The magi in Matthew 2 are presumably astrologers. It's stars they're interested in. And that's the world. Historically, there is an origin for the word magi, that they were one of the tribes which would have been around the area of Tehran, and they were the priests for that nation over in that area, the priestly class. But they gradually became more and more associated across the whole world with this area of magic. So here you've got these guys working. These are guys. Magician to us is probably a bit of a trivial. These are more guys who are viewed as having special knowledge. These are guys who know things. And they walk into Jerusalem. Let me say a word about astrology. Actually, just before I do that, I'll just go back and just say a couple of other things. I would assume that these are pretty high-end astrologers, because they first get taken seriously by a king and the leaders, but secondly, they've got some pretty valuable gifts they can give. So these aren't your kind of the backstreet peddlers of a bit of information. These are probably pretty senior, and actually traditionally they've been called kings, haven't they, as well? So who knows what they were really, but they almost certainly were pretty high-end in their trade. However, let me just say a word about astrology. The ability to gain special insight into the world affairs from observations of heavenly objects. And let me say, astrology is alive and well in our culture right at the moment. This is an article from The Guardian on the 9th of August this year,
Astrology is without doubt having a cultural moment, as well as a rapid proliferation of apps such as, astrological app, which has been downloaded more than 3 million times since 2017. Astrology memes are a staple of Instagram and Twitter and have sparked a huge boost in traffic in women's news sites. So in other words, people are going to women's news sites through memes about astrology. There is a huge interest, and it would amaze me if there aren't numbers of us in this room here who perhaps look at our stars or do that thing. That is probably the case, even though we're a group of Christians. And I just want to say, Christian people do not get involved in astrology. Divination is specifically forbidden in the Old Testament. Trying to tell the future, and astrology is a means of doing that. And also, astrology is shown to be futile, and there's a reference in Isaiah, and a reference in Daniel. Daniel, talking to King Nebuchadnezzar, says, you know, your magicians cannot give you the answer to your question. The only person who can do this is there's a God in heaven, and he knows what your future is, and he can tell you. But those, it's not possible for any other wisdom to tell you what your future is. And so it's futile. So just let me say that clearly. Let's keep away from astrology, please. It won't help us. And in fact, it'll get us confused and tied up in knots. So let's just hear that one, please. But let me just say a little word about awe and wonder. The stars can and do speak of God's glory. Psalm 19, 1-4. For the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hand. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world. In the heavens God has pitched a tent for the sun, etc., etc., etc. God can and does speak through heavenly bodies. And there's the a little bit from that psalm, and there's that statement. You know, and if you look at Luke 21:5, here's Jesus speaking. 21:25, Luke 21:25, there will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. On the earth, nations will be in anguish and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the seas. Jesus is saying there'll be signs in the heavenly bodies. And then if you go on to Acts 2, verse 19, I will show wonders in the heavens above and signs in the earth below. Blood and fire will billow and billows of smoke. Here's the issue, which the church has been consistent about down the ages. The trouble with astrology is that it says the stars can determine your life. And what the church has always said, what the Bible says is, no, you and I have choice. Your course is not set by the stars. We choose whether we respond to God or not, and we determine those things. But what it's also saying is, but we can be led to understand something of God and glory in God from what he's created. Does that make sense? Okay, so finally then, the stars. Okay, I have for a long time thought that it's not a searchlight beam coming down pointing to a place. I've got several reasons for this. Actually, I went on a mini tour with David Scott. He organised it with a few this week. And apparently, in the newest minis, you can order. So when you open the door, it projects onto the road, "Welcome, James." How nice would that be? I wonder what they charge for it, though. but I don't believe it was like that. I don't think it was light coming down. Here are three reasons why not. Because this star wasn't just a guide. It had to contain a message. They knew it was his star. It was the star of this coming king, and they knew what gifts to bring. It wasn't, oh, look, there's a light there. Let's just follow it and see where it takes us. It said something. Secondly, why did they end up in Jerusalem? If they were following a light, why did he go to Jerusalem? Why not straight to Bethlehem? And the third reason is, I don't know optically how you do it. You know, What sort of power beam would you need to come from the stars and to hit one location on Earth? I mean, it probably would blow a hole through, you know. Goodness knows what sort of optics you'd need for that or what sort of power you'd... So that picture I don't accept for that reason. Nor do I accept the reason of some dramatic, unusual light. A comet shooting across the sky, even less a shooting star because that's far too short, or even something like a supernova or something like that. Everyone would have seen that. Everyone would have seen that. But what's happened here is clearly that these magi have seen something which in Jerusalem they have not seen. So it has to be something with a slightly different feel to it than that kind of an object. I would rather think of it as something more typically astrological, or the way astrologers work. Astrologers look at the sky, or the ancient astrologers did, and they'll see the different star constellations, and they'll look at the wandering stars, which we know are planets now, and they'll say, which constellation are these planets in? How are they coming together? All those things. They're interpreting the stars. And erroneously, but they thought it worked. And these magi had seen something in the stars that made them think, there's a new king in Israel. The Messiah's come. And what is more, when they get to Jerusalem and they say, where is the one who's been born king of the Jews? And they explain why they think it. All of Jerusalem is troubled, and so is Herod. What's happening? They're saying, goodness me, it was in plain sight, and we hadn't seen how those things came together, and said that. There was probably a sense of, you're right. We can understand why you've come to that conclusion. That's kind of where I've landed on my thinking about this. When they say they've seen his star rising in the east, they mean they've seen the signs in the stars which have shown them that that's what they think it is. And so they come to the capital of Jerusalem, where the palace of Herod is, because they assume the new king will be born there. And that's why they end up in that place. And I think that's probably why the wise men were taken so seriously, because as the folk looked at what they had to say, they could see that in terms of the logic of their day and age, it made sense. Does that make sense? And so they get there. Okay, now with all that in mind, let me read the story to you, and you can then listen to it now with that background information. It might be good if you've got Bibles to open the Bibles. It'll be on the screen. But if you have Bibles, you can then keep an eye on where we're getting to in the story. And if you want to focus on one bit and keep looking at it, you can. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who's been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judea, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report it to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother to escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he'd been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted, because they are no more." Let's just pause with that thought for a moment before we just tie some of these thoughts together. I just want to end up by talking about four things I think that God is saying through this story. So we've looked at the key players, Herod, the Magi, and the star, and we've read the story. And now I just want us to think about what God is saying. God calls attention to the significance of this royal infant. The first thing he's saying is, here's a sign that this is somebody really important. Last week, the sign of the miraculous birth. Next week, with the shepherds, the sign of angels speaking. This week, the signs in the heavens. All through the whole story, there's the sign of prophecy fulfilled. Of course, the ultimate sign is the resurrection of Jesus. And down the ages, there's the sign of the church. What God has done through his people and how God has changed the world. God has spoken. God has spoken. He's made it very clear that Jesus is wonderful, that Jesus is glorified. He's glorious. God has made it very clear that Jesus is somebody who every human being needs to listen to receive and accept. God has spoken. That's the testimony. Jesus said, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." It's not that God hasn't spoken. Do we have ears to hear? Second thing that God is saying is God announces that the Messiah is for all nations. God speaks to Gentiles. He invites Gentiles to witness this beginning of the coming of the Messiah. Right there near the beginning. We also see that the Gentiles actually are more receptive to God's message than the rulers of God's people. You know, in Matthew itself, 21-22, we've got these powerful stories of how Jesus' own people reject him. You can look at those later. The religion of Jesus has never been about one nation. Jesus is a blessing for all nations. You know, it's interesting how, you know, you go to different nations of the world and they'll say, Christianity is the West. We are Indian, or we're Middle Eastern, Arabic, or we're, you know, with the whole, that Black Power movement. So Christianity is about the white, so we want Islam, because that's more about us. You know, in our day and age, I guess it's Christianity is for the past, not the present. in Western culture. Jesus for everyone. This announces that. God speaks in the language that will be understood. The Magi could read the signs in the stars, so God gave them the signs. I think this is one of the most beautiful things for me, that that God speaks in the language that we can understand. You know, at Pentecost, in the sermon there, all languages being spoken, so they could all understand. The incarnation itself, that God leaves heaven and comes to earth. Why? To speak to us. 1 Corinthians 9:22, I have become all things to all people, that by all possible means I might save some. Paul the Apostle says, I am willing to change and adapt and become different things so that the thing which won't change, which is the gospel, can be heard. And that raises for me that big question. Am I working? Am I praying? Am I thinking about how do I make this gospel packaged in the language that the people around me can understand? How will it be understood by my family? How will it be understood by my neighbors? How will it be understood by my work colleagues? What is the language that I'm going to use? God isn't pro-astrology at all, but he used it to speak to these men. He ordered the stars to speak to these men. I find that inspiring. And finally, the presence of Jesus, the King, demands decision. God speaks. God speaks. The signs are there. And therefore causes division between those who accept and those who reject him. There will always be that division. You know, it's written big in this story, isn't it? Because you've got these magi who've packed their bags, got their presents, saddled their donkeys or whatever, camels or whatever they rode on, however they arrived there, traveled miles because God has spoken. And you have Herod, who's showing all the evidence and says, I want to kill. It's the same message that God's given to both of them in the stars, if they want to see it. One says, I want to worship. One says, I want to kill. You know, that's always the way. It's always the way. We all have the choice of my own rule or the rule of Christ. Will I be king or will Jesus be king? You see, Herod wanted to be king. He didn't want Jesus to be king. So we have the same choice as Herod. You and I, we may not be brutal murderers like Herod was. We may not be psychopaths like Herod was, but we have the same choice. Will I let Jesus be king in here of my life? Or do I want to stay king in here of my life and shut out the message of Jesus? Let me just put this image up as David comes back up with the band. God speaks, awe and wonder, awesome message. Some rejoice and want to worship. Some are troubled by the word of God. And the question for us is, the wonderful message of Jesus, are we responding to that by saying, Jesus, I want you, my king? Or are we saying, look, Jesus, I just want to shut you out because actually I want to run my own life? That's the question. You know, I do hope there's some here today who really want to make that first step and say, Jesus, you know, I've been wanting some sort of proof, but you've already spoken loud and clear, and I just want to receive you. And if that's you, please come talk to me afterwards or come down the front. The prayer ministry team would love to talk to you. They'll be over this side of the church at the front here. Come and talk about receiving Jesus. But maybe others of us are following Jesus. But we recognize that little by little we've kind of taken back a bit of the control of our own lives. We've actually asserted that we're king again. And actually, Jesus keeps speaking to us, but we keep saying, actually, Jesus, I want to do it my own way. You know, we always have that choice. Will we crown Jesus as king, or do we want to stay king ourselves? Amen.